Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 107, I have the distinct pleasure of being joined by Dr. Gary Wartz, a cataract surgeon, entrepreneur, and podcast host who hosts the widely consumed podcast, Ophthalmology Off the Grid. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Gary Wartz. Dr. Wartz is in practice in Lexington, Kentucky, and is Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at University of Kentucky. He is also the host of Ophthalmology Off the Grid, arguably the most popular podcast in our field, and definitely my favorite. Dr. Wartz, thank you for joining us.
Jay, it is my distinct pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You are a new guest to the show, so we usually start by asking all of our new guests the same questions that will help inspire medical students or even residents and fellows listening to the show. How did you decide on ophthalmology, and then what drew you to become an anterior segment surgeon after that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, I went into med school thinking I was going to be a trauma surgeon. And I think to me at the time, it just seemed like the most, like the special forces of medicine, you know, whatever was the hardest, most gung-ho, that's sort of what I wanted to do. And that's, I guess that's sort of my personality flaw I'm giving away right now. But so I went in med school thinking trauma surgery. I did research at the University of Louisville with the trauma department. And then I guess I met some trauma surgeons and realized that I just didn't really jive with them. It really was, I think it was a culture thing. I realized that, and also my daughter was born right after my first year of med school. And I really had a moment where I said, all right, what do I want out of life? Do I want to be living at the hospital and being called in at all hours of the night? Or do I want to maybe have a chance to be more of a family man and have some time to pursue some other things? And at the same time, I was really being drawn to microsurgery. I saw some plastic surgery being done with vascular reanastomoses, and really thought that again, I was sort of drawn to the challenge of microsurgery. And so I switched gears. I knew I still wanted to be a surgeon, but was thinking microsurgery. And then I saw cataract surgery, and cataract surgery is kind of the gateway drug to ophthalmology. And I saw Dr. Asim Paracha out of Louisville do some cataracts, and it was honestly the coolest surgery I'd ever seen. And it was really an aha moment for me. I said, I think I could do this the rest of my life. This would be a fulfilling job. I can see the work of my hands, and very rewarding to help people with the quality of life. So that's really pretty much it in a nutshell.
And then right now, what does your typical week look like? We'll get into the podcast in a minute, but in your practice and how you interact with the University of Kentucky academic program.
Yeah. So my schedule is kind of unique. Aside from those two things, I also wear the hat of chief medical officer for Omega Ophthalmics. That's a startup that I created or co-founded about 6 years ago. And it's basically a lens company. So we're developing a novel lens. So basically, I spend a couple of days a week doing chief medical officer duties for Omega Ophthalmics, basically taking care of the medical side of the business, looking at designs and writing patents and reviewing data and all that sort of thing. And then 3 or 4 days a week, depending, I'm usually either in the clinic or in the OR doing surgery. And I'm in an anterior segment practice where we specialize in cataract and refractive surgery. So from laser cataract surgery to LASIK, PRK, specialty implants, and you know, even doing the complex cataracts that essentially no one else wants to do. We really do it all. We're not a cornea practice, so we don't tackle the DMECs or penetrating grafts, but otherwise anterior segment, we're pretty involved.
So we usually have retina specialists on, but I think it's always interesting to get an anterior segment perspective. And even though we're all ophthalmologists, it's interesting that even within a field, there are different cultures, stereotypes, biases. But one of the things that's important is crosstalk between retina specialists and the referring doctors, who are often anterior segment surgeons. So tell us a little bit about, for fellows, young retina attendings who are starting their practices, what sort of things do you look for in the retina doctors that you work with? What sort of things can they do to work better with their anterior segment colleagues and communicate?
Well, there's sort of a saying, beware of retina doctors bearing gifts. So, you know, in my community, I work pretty heavily with Dr. John Kitchens, who is legendary. I mean, he's legendary as a human because he's so nice and he gives so much professionally and personally to this field that we love. He's legendary in the operating room just to watch him operate. He does operate without socks on. I don't know if anyone knows that, but he does operate barefoot. That's a whole other conversation that we'll have to have with John at some point. But watching him operate is, you know, it's really just like watching, you know, a master at his craft. That being said, you know, retina, the things that you all do to the back of the eye really can create havoc for a cataract surgeon. So I get to do all of the silicone oil cases. I get to do all the cases that no one else wants to touch. You know, these are cataracts that I really wish would have come out years ago, perhaps. So I guess if I had one wish to send out to my retina colleagues, it would be just get that lens out as soon as possible, because the longer a phakic lens exists inside of a diseased eye, really the worse it gets for everyone. And, you know, I had a case a few months ago now where, you know, it was a silicone oil detachment. So it was a white cataract. The patient was a diabetic. The anterior capsule, first of all, I had to put 5 hooks in because the pupil was so phimotic and scarred down with sneaky eye. So we've got 5 hooks in. We've got, 2 paracenteses. I've got my main incision, and I can't tear. I literally cannot tear the anterior capsule with my cystotome. So I have to use scissors to cut the capsule because it's like leather. And I actually have to make another main incision nasally to be able to get my scissors in to cut the capsule on the nasal side. So basically this eye ends up having, 8, 9 incisions in it by the time I'm done. You know, thankfully we got it out and put a lens in the bag. But I would just say that, a phakic eye that is having a lot of inflammatory or potential inflammatory problems posteriorly probably should be pseudophakic as soon as possible.
That's a great point. And that leads into my next question, which is from an anterior segment perspective, and there's always personal taste that factors into this. Obviously, the gold standard is a lens in the bag. But in cases where you refer to a retina colleague or even just as a casual observer, just seeing, what kind of secondary lenses do you generally, what are your thoughts on secondary lenses? I mean, and I'll give you the whole spectrum. There's anterior chamber IOLs, there's iris sutured lenses, there's scleral sutured lenses, and there's scleral fixated lenses. And they're all wonderful techniques in the right hands, and all of them can be not so wonderful techniques in the wrong hands. But what are your general takes on these cases? And when do you feel anterior segment surgeons do them and when retinal surgeons do them?
You know, I think I've migrated. So I used to be fairly comfortable and I guess default to an anterior chamber lens. And it probably just had to do with the fact that technically it was easier and, elderly patients, tended to do fairly well with them and studies had shown really not a huge difference. But then I was introduced to the Yamani technique, the scleral fixated technique that Shin Yamani described. And after I saw that and started performing that, I was really hooked. Now, to be fair, I've not done a lot of other techniques really to compare, but this just seemed so elegant that it was something that I wanted to learn, and I've done, a fair number at this point. So, when I have someone who's aphakic, actually, sometimes the retina doctors will send them to me to do secondary lenses, and I'm very comfortable, doing that. So, and it goes both ways. They do them as well. I would really say that it really depends on what you're comfortable with, what tools you have. Do you have the EC3 PAL lens available and the right power? Because I've had situations where I didn't, and trying to do the Yamani technique with different 3-piece lenses it can be done, but I wouldn't really recommend it. It's not for the faint of heart. So I really like the Yamani technique with the EC3 PAL lens with the PVDF haptics. That's my go-to, and I've had really, really fantastic results with it.
Yeah, it's a great point about how there's so much geographic variation. This is a question fellows will ask, but I think who does the secondary lenses depends on what area you're in and who's comfortable doing what. I think I've seen, like you said, people may refer to you if that's what you're comfortable doing, and it works both ways depending on who's in the area and what they're doing.
Right.
So In terms of the other things you do, obviously one of the biggest things people know you for is the podcast, which is Ophthalmology Off the Grid. How did this come to fruition? When did you first decide to do this? And how do you keep up with the podcast now that you also, you know, you talked about you're the CMO for this company, you have a busy practice, you're academically involved. How do you balance all of this now and keep it going after now it's been multiple years?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm kind of an extrovert, if you can't tell. So I like talking to people. I'm passionate about ophthalmology, and I like learning from people. And what I realized was I was having very good conversations with really amazing ophthalmologists on a weekly or maybe sometimes, you know, a couple times a month basis. And what I realized was probably the things I was asking them or the insights they were sharing would be very valuable, not just to me, but really to everyone. And so I started thinking about how do I leverage the thing I like to do anyways, which is talking to interesting people who are also similarly interested in ophthalmology. And especially if someone has a particular niche inside of ophthalmology, you know, would it be worthwhile to spend a little extra time to record that conversation and essentially just put it out in the form of a podcast? And so as I was mulling that over, I was invited to come on to a friend of mine's podcast for emergency medicine. And apparently ER physicians podcasting has been a big thing in that field for a while. And just like you mentioned, regionally, you know, things are different. I think within different fields of medicine, certain things become popular and sort of take off. And ER medicine was really pretty quick on the stick with podcasting. So it was sort of a confluence of a number of things. And it just so happened that I had a pretty good relationship with David Cox, who is one of the heads of BMC. And I really just called him and said, David, I've got this idea. I don't think anyone's really doing it. I think there's an unmet need and a potential lane to be created. Would you mind if I did a podcast? And he sort of thought about it for about 10 seconds and said, yeah, sure, do it. Record some calls and send it to us and we'll figure it out. So it really, you know, the origin story is not glamorous. Mm-hmm. It's only glamorous in the rearview mirror that it was really just a random conversation with about 10 seconds of due diligence, and the rest is kind of history.
And now, this is something that you've been doing and you've been very, very consistent. You're the model for me as well as everyone else who started doing ophthalmology-related podcasts. How do you develop content? How do you come up with the episode ideas? And how do you keep it fresh and going so many years in? Maybe we can take some inspiration for our own team.
You want my secret. I know. No, I mean, there's really no secret to it. I will say I sort of have copied Tim Ferriss. I'm not sure if you listen to Tim Ferriss's podcast. He is the author of The 4-Hour Workweek. He's authored a number of other really great books. And he is sort of a Renaissance man, really interested in a lot of topics. And what's interesting about his podcast is he finds people who are inherently interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have a specialty in one field or another. But it's interesting. I found that his podcast really didn't have a theme other than he liked talking to interesting people about what makes them tick. And so after about a year of doing podcasts where it was very content related, okay, what's new in LASIK, controversies in MIGS, presbyopic IOLs, toric versus, you know, LRIs, very topical, I realized that you can really only do that for so long before you have to start recycling topics, because ophthalmology, though it is, you know, very interesting and we can go really deep on things, the topics can be sort of self-limiting. But what was not limited was the quality of the people inside of our field. And so I really switched from pursuing a certain topic to really trying to interview people who I thought were interesting. And I knew if I found an interesting person, the conversation would no doubt become interesting. And, you know, it really, for me, this is the funniest thing is I feel like personally I've gotten more out of this than anyone else, because I'm like a kid in the candy shop. I get to talk to the smartest people on the planet about things I'm interested in, and I get to ask them whatever I want, and I get to self-direct my own learning by really just sitting at their feet and letting them talk to me. So for me, it's really born out of being maybe a little bit lazy and selfish. I just wanted all the good stuff for me. And if other people enjoy it, then so be it.
It's so funny because that was kind of the hidden benefit I didn't expect, which was, again, it doesn't feel like work when you're doing it. And you do learn a lot because you're talking, again, to these really brilliant, talented people who have tremendous things they have done and ideas. And it really is very inspiring. So, I mean, you mentioned a Renaissance man. You're someone who has many interests. What do you do outside of your work activities? You talked about one of the reasons you chose ophthalmology was to have that balanced life. What else do you do?
Well, it's really funny because people who are workaholics who choose fields that have potential for a lot of free time find a lot of things inside of field to fill it with. So, you know, I sort of say I like free time, but I end up filling any gaps in my time with interesting projects. So a lot of my free time, I end up working on my startup, so Omega Ophthalmics. We've been very active, especially recently with a recent human trial overseas. Other than that, I really enjoy being a dad, to be honest, and a husband. I've got two children and a wife, been married at this point 18 years, which is fantastic. And so my kids occupy a lot of my time. We spend a lot of time together. They both, I think, want to go into ophthalmology or optometry. So I think the dominant gene of ophthalmology has it's presented in them. I also enjoy reading. I like reading philosophy. I like reading theology and religion. So I sort of like keeping my mind active in areas outside of the true sciences. I like really reading humanities. And every year I try and give myself a challenge of one form or another. So last year I taught myself how to play the guitar. And so I really enjoy now playing the guitar, which is kind of, I'm not great at it and really probably a B minus or a maybe not even a B level guitar player, probably maybe not even a C level, but I enjoy that. It's a great release. And I really enjoy exercising. So I found a lot of balance, I think, in getting outside of work and going and blowing off some steam at the gym before I come home. I think it makes me a little bit more centered.
Well, Dr. Wartz, thank you so much for your time and coming on. I'm going to leave you with one last question, which is an open one. You can take it any way you'd like to. We're flattered and humbled because we have a lot of trainees who listen to us. In fact, I think the major base listening are fellows at this point or people who recently graduated fellowship. So as, again, you're not a retinal surgeon, but you're someone who's been successful. You've been out. You're an anterior segment surgeon. And you've seen what great retinal surgeons like Dr. Kitchens have done with their careers. What sort of parting advice would you leave for these young, bright-eyed people heading out into the real world of ophthalmology?
You know, I would say there are probably two bits of advice I would give. They may seem to be inconsistent, but number one, I would say take a deep breath, realize this is a marathon, not a sprint. When you're looking for a job, when you get out of residency, really look at the quality and the longevity of that potential opportunity rather than the bonus structure, the base salary, all those sorts of things. It's really hard advice to take because when you're coming out of fellowship, you're at your poorest level ever. And so it's sort of like telling a starving man to be really picky with his first meal. But I would say try your best to look at your career in terms of decades rather than 1 to 2 year little segments. The opposite side of that is it's okay to be ambitious. It is okay to want to change the world and light the world on fire. Make sure that you do things outside of work. Make sure that you stay engaged. You know, go to the meetings, do research, present your ideas. We need to have as many ophthalmologists pouring their heart and soul into this field because when we all give that little extra, you know, the rising tide floats all boats, and that to me makes our profession so much fun. When I see an ophthalmologist who is, you know, trying to change their little segment of the world, you know, I think it really makes it very interesting. So make sure that you're looking at this as a marathon, but also don't be afraid to sprint a few segments here and there.
Well, Dr. Gortz, thanks so much for your time and for joining us. And as a last note, if we have listeners who have not encountered your podcast for whatever reason or don't know where to find it, what's the easiest way for them to access it?
So if you go to iTunes, you can type in Ophthalmology Off the Grid, and that's probably the easiest way to find it. It's very easy to subscribe. And when you subscribe, new episodes will automatically download to your phone as soon as they're up.
Beautiful. Well, Dr. Wirtz, thanks again for all your time. It was a lot of fun doing this, and thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's R-E-T-I-N-A, podcast.com. All 107 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Red and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at RetinaPodcast. And to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback on things we can do better, things we are already doing well. We appreciate anyone who subscribes via the Apple Podcasts or Google Play apps to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Gary Wirtz for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, thank you listeners for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.